You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 167 by Rudolf Steiner, a book entitled The Human Spirit, Past and Present, Occult Fraternities and the Mystery of Golgotha, translated by Matthew Barton. It's 12 lectures. This is Lecture 4, given on the 4th of April, 1916. Today I want to pass to more occult aspects of the things we spoke of a week ago. As we saw, certain occult streams expressed in the form of occult fraternities can be considered important for human life. As you will have seen from our more outward reflections last week, such occult fraternities of a very distinctive hue are employed in British lands in order to achieve certain outward aims. Now, it is necessary for anyone who joins a spiritual scientific movement today with his eyes open to be able to assess such things with a degree of objectivity, to survey the field and current situation. Today, therefore, I will speak of how we must conceive of the work of such occult fraternities in general, so that we can see from this how they may become an instrument for certain other aims and purposes. What we refer to here as an occult fraternity is in fact a very complex matter. But this complexity is founded on a substructure in which people are guided in a particular direction by coming together in a kind of rite and being given certain symbols. They gather together in a kind of ritual manner that comes to expression in symbols. There are a great many people today who think with some scorn of such fraternities, who think, wrongly, that they know enough about them to ridicule them and the symbolism they employ. There is a great deal of short-sightedness in relation to all such things today. To those who lightly dismiss the importance of certain ceremonies and symbols connected with the occult fraternities, we can simply reply that people ultimately, no less important than themselves, these enlightened monists and others who scorn and ridicule such things, have placed great value on experiencing ceremonial and symbolic rites. One such person was Goethe, who well knew what he had gained thereby, and repeatedly expressed this in one way or another. Instead of a school education, he was able to undergo a form of education later on that was connected with certain Freemason orders. This may have given less important figures than Goethe less than it gave him, but it gave him a very great deal. People who scorn and ridicule such things might do well to consider this, but to understand the deeper nature of these orders and their rites, we need to be able to study them more closely. As you know, we have been living in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch since the beginning of the 15th century. This was preceded by the fourth post-Atlantean era, beginning around 747 BC, and only really ending at the beginning of the 15th century. People who today are very, very clever, and almost all of them are, aren't they? Think that what the human soul experiences since the 15th century cannot be very different from what it experienced in the two millennia before that, back to 747 BC. But even very external things can show us how fundamentally different the human soul was in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, the one that preceded ours. From the 8th century BC to the late 14th century AD, though, of course, this waned a great deal as the 15th century approached, the human etheric body was much, much more receptive than it has been since then. It was capable of perceiving much more of what surrounded it. And when the ether body perceives things, it perceives the elemental world. It does not only perceive minerals, plants, animals, water, air, and so forth, as the physical body does, but it perceives, rather, the elemental beings alive in plants, animals, and minerals. Today, people think that descriptions from those days of gnomes or sprites that were perceived in mountain regions, in mines and caves, were just poetic inventions. But this is not so. The people in those days really did still know of the existence of an elemental world behind the physical world. Not all present here may know that even external documentation can prove this, that people still knew about the elemental world until relatively recently. I believe I have mentioned here before a picture in Hamburg Museum. The picture depicts the fall, in other words, the event we read about in Genesis. A painter who depicts this theme today is likely to show the Tree of Paradise and Adam and Eve, either side of it, portrayed in a more or less beautiful and in fact often rather ugly fashion. Coiled around the tree, usually, is the snake, a real snake. But is this actually realistic, my dear friends? Can we call this realism? Naturally, Eve was not yet as clever and intelligent as modern women are. But nevertheless, it is a little far-fetched to think that she would be tempted by a real snake that crawls in the grass to commit this act. We therefore cannot consider this kind of depiction realistic. But we know that the tempter was, in fact, Lucifer, not a being that can be seen with today's physical eyes. One can only see him with the awoken etheric body, with awoken clairvoyance. We find that he was the being who remained behind at the moon stage of evolution. From old moon evolution, we largely already received our physical body as we know it today, although at that time it was not yet physically visible, existed only etherically. A modern person's head today is a reflection of the head that already existed during old moon evolution. But the rest of the human body, attached to it, did not yet then exist in its modern form, but only as a snake-like appendage, in what we now have as our spinal column. And thus, if we were to depict Lucifer as he remained behind from moon evolution, one would have to portray him with a human head and a spinal column attached to it, a snake-like form, in other words. And this is precisely how the painter Master Bertram portrayed Lucifer in the 13th, 14th century. Not as a modern painter does, but in a way that fully accords with spiritual science. You can see the picture in Hamburg Museum, and can discover that a painter of the 13th or 14th century painted things as they really are. Unfortunately, people today are too clever to acknowledge the telling nature of this picture, but it documents the fact that human beings still perceived the etheric world up until the time we have been speaking of. At this period, the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, arose the symbols upon which occult fraternities are founded. The symbols used were something that people still experienced as vividly alive in the fourth post-Atlantean era, as something living within them. I will try to clarify the ideas embodied in these symbols in the way Goethe communicated them. In his own way, Goethe tried to render symbolism fruitful for outward life, considering that one could make great inner progress, could gain great benefit from engaging deeply with symbolism. As you can see in his title, Wilhelm Meister, He wanted education to be conducted so that human beings grew up within a certain milieu of symbolism. Instead of learning the trivialities people nowadays often learn in grammar schools, he wanted them to be informed by a certain language of symbolism. He wanted them, above all, to learn through symbols what we call the, quote, four human venerations, close quote, for the world of spirit, for the physical world, for every human soul, and then the veneration founded on these other three, a reverence for oneself. Most enlightened people today would, of course, probably relate well enough to the last of these, wouldn't they? But in Goethe's view, this reverence, which is in a sense connected with the greatest dangers, would only emerge from the foundation created by the other three. How does Goethe think that veneration for the spirit should be incorporated into us? He wishes us to learn a certain gesture, arms crossed over the chest, and our gaze turned upward. And in this stance, we should acquire a reverence for the spirit's influence upon us. At a certain, still very young age, Goethe thinks, we should connect this gesture with a feeling of reverence for what is above us. Why is this significant? It has a certain importance because when we really feel reverence for the spirit, we can do no other than give expression to it. And if we placed our physical hands together upon our back, our etheric hands would cross in front. And our gaze, however much we cast it downward as physical glance, would be turned upward with our etheric eyes. This is the natural gesture for etheric eyes, turned upward, and for etheric hands, crossed in front of us. This is something the etheric body actually does when this reverence for the spirit is present. It is inevitable, self-evident, that the etheric body assumes this gesture. In the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, people still knew this, because they sensed the movements of the etheric body within them. And when they were told to adopt this gesture, they were being told only that they should enliven and perceive the etheric gestures by making the physical correspond to it. Thus Goethe sought a way to grow into the life of spirit. He knew that there is real meaning in fully experiencing the gestures connected with direct expressions of inner life. In the same way, he wanted a person to cross his hands behind his back and cast his gaze downward when he acquires reverence for the corporeal realm, for everything earthly. That was the second thing he thought people should acquire. And the third thing was this, outspread hands with a gaze turning to right and left should teach them reverence for every other human soul. And this would be the foundation for acquiring a reverence for one's own soul. This direct knowledge that such gestures, when they are right, are not something arbitrary, but are connected with the human being's spiritual organization, is something that humankind has largely lost sight of since the 14th century. Before the 15th century, people were easily awoken to inner experience through such gestures, along with more complex ones. From the 5th post-Atlantean era onward, it is perfectly possible to teach young people simple gestures such as these, if they are taught in the appropriate way. And this is also something that Goethe wishes. But after the 14th or 15th centuries, the more complex gestural language of, quote, symbol, handshake, and word, close quote, as this is current within secret fraternities, could no longer be taught to people in a way that enabled them to sense its reality. And so, while these fraternities that existed in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch continued to develop with three consecutive degrees involving the teaching of symbols, handshakes and words, among other things, the different nature of human souls in recent centuries meant that people no longer really connected with these things. If we stay with the simplest of such things, with symbol, handshake, and word, people felt no real connection with them because they could no longer experience the ether body corresponding to these things in a way that accorded with the human soul. It became something outward and external. You see, in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, the rational and mind-soul had chiefly developed in humankind, but now the consciousness soul began to seize hold of them. In other words, people began to be reliant on the powers of reason connected with the physical brain. What we can call the sensitivity of the etheric body receded. And what is surfacing today? Please listen carefully as I describe what must now appear. Occult fraternities thus continue into this fifth post-Atlantean epoch. Occult brotherhoods continue to be founded or are perpetuated, and they admit people to whom corresponding symbols are introduced. These people learn certain symbols by means of adopting a particular bodily stance and position that expresses them. They learn certain handshakes in which they take hold of another person's hand in other than the usual way. They learn to utter certain words that signify a very specific activity of the etheric body and other such things. I will only mention these basic aspects. Thus, people have been learning such symbols, handshakes, and words since the 15th or 16th centuries, but their nature is now such that the consciousness soul is at work in them. And these symbols, handshakes, and words do not influence the consciousness soul, but remain something very external to it. Yet, you must not think for a moment that such things, symbol, handshake, and word, do not still work upon our etheric body. They do indeed. We absorb through symbol, handshake, and word what is implicit in and related to them. Thus, through teaching a number of people these symbols, handshakes, and words, their subconscious learns something that they do not possess in their conscious awareness. Naturally, this is something that very definitely should not be done, but instead we should proceed in a way that human evolution requires, which is to appeal to the human mind. In other words, we teach people what their mind and understanding can first encompass and learn, which is the content of spiritual science. This content of spiritual science must first be comprehended, and by this means, we must first approach people. First, people must stand in some way within the spiritual scientific movement, and only after some time has passed can symbol, handshake, and word be introduced to them in a way they can receive, because they have been properly prepared. They can find something familiar in it, for they have at least understood it. Normally, this is not done in occult brotherhoods. People are admitted to the first degree of an order without previously having learned anything of spiritual science or occultism. Symbols, handshakes, and words are conveyed to them before they have learned anything about the world of spirit. And this means that their subconscious is influenced by something unconnected with their conscious awareness. What is the outcome of this? If one so desires, one can thereby make people into pliant tools for all kinds of plans. You see, if you work upon the etheric body without the human being knowing this, you exclude the powers of reason he otherwise possesses, if you do not also give the mind something that spiritual science must be today. You exclude this, and then make such fraternities into a tool of those who seek to realize their plans and aims. And then you can use such brotherhoods to pursue certain political aims. Or you can cultivate the dogma that Alcyone is the outward physical bearer of Christ Jesus. Those who have been prepared by these means will become willing instruments to disseminate such things. One need only be dishonest and unrighteous enough, and then one can achieve all kinds of things by such means, by using others as instruments. These things become apparent to true insight and knowledge. Those who know the difference and the distinction between the fifth and the fourth post-Atlantean epochs, something we keep reiterating, will also know why one must first acquaint oneself with spiritual science, and only then be introduced to occult symbols. Wherever spiritual science is being pursued with really honest intent, this course will naturally be followed. No harm of any kind will come to someone who has only become acquainted, say, with what he finds in my title Theosophy or title Occult Science and seeks to understand it. He will not suffer harm through the unexplained communication of symbols. In British lands, particularly, we see the utter lack of any teaching or explanation as an introduction to such symbols. Explanation does not mean us saying that this symbol means this or that, for here anyone can be told anything. Such teaching should be of a kind that discloses secrets based on a preceding delineation of the course of the evolution of humankind and the world, and only then moves on to show how the symbols arise from this. This does not happen. The symbols are simply given. In fact, they are not even simply given in this way, but in another way. Instead of basing them on literature such as our spiritual science, they are related to a literature in which, really, everything is given symbolically. In many respects, the greatest mischief has been done with this occult literature in France by Eliphas Levi, whose books, titled Dogma and Ritual of Higher Magic, and titled The Key to Higher Magic, contain great truths, certainly, but all mixed up with very dangerous errors. Their nature is such that they cannot easily be rationally comprehended, as our spiritual science can, but must be assimilated symbolically. Read Eliphas Levi. You can read him without danger, of course, because you have been sufficiently prepared. If you read his book titled Dogma and Ritual of Higher Magic, then you will see how the whole symbolic method differs from what we do. Yes, my dear friends, if one instructs others in purely symbolic ways, as Eliphas Levi does, then one can basically use them for whatever purposes one desires. Things became still worse after Eliphas Levi with the appearance of Dr. Enkhauza, otherwise known as Papus, who gained such devastating and dangerous influence at the court of St. Petersburg. He repeatedly stayed there and played a disastrous political role in events. Papus, as he calls himself, readers aside, I'm pronouncing that Papus, it's P-A-P-U-S, it could be Papus. I like the sound of Papus, end of readers aside. Papus, as he calls himself, communicated certain occult secrets to humanity, but in a dire, dangerous way. And those who allow him to influence them hold fast to his teaching, once they have got beyond the basics, with a rigid fanaticism. It is not a matter of refuting Papus, for as paradoxical as this may sound, the worst thing about him is that he writes a great many things that are correct. It is the way in which he gives them that is so dangerous. To trickle into weak souls the things contained in Papus's books means to prepare them to utterly lull their reason to sleep, so that they can be used for whatever purpose is desired. People like papists exert an influence today. Anyone who has some experience of these things will know that papists exerts a major influence. I traced this influence through Bohemia and Austria. His influence is far less great in Germany, though here too it was present until a certain point in time. But he is particularly influential in Russia, and this was also achieved through a certain dishonesty that is connected with all these matters. In the 18th century, the teachings of Jacob Boehme, of whom we have often spoken, were transplanted to France by St. Martin, the so-called Philosophe Inconnu. He reproduced them in a really very charming style, and so when they were translated back into German again, the works of St. Martin were of course much more readable for people than had been the works of Boehme himself, whose difficulty is widely acknowledged. I myself have a fond memory of translations of St. Martin, this unknown philosopher. The book by him, in English, Of Truth and Error, was beautifully translated into German by a fine, well-known German poet. I have a particular interest in this, since a small pamphlet by me, entitled The Mission of Spiritual Science and Its Building in Dornach, will shortly appear. There I try to refute some common errors about spiritual science in a brief popular form. This essay, soon to be published, arose from a lecture I gave in Switzerland, because there in Dornach itself a very clever Protestant priest had suggested a great many things. But in the end I did not wish to confine myself to what this priest had said, although it was rather typical. People raise all sorts of things, and without specifically mentioning the priest, I was able to refute some of these common errors people entertain about our spiritual science, especially also about our building in Dornach. In a lecture the priest gave, he quoted a poem. I spoke of this once here, by Matthias Claudius. He recited a verse of this poem, seemingly one of great pathos, to show that people really ought not to speak of something like a secret science or doctrine, since even the moon was beyond ordinary comprehension. But if you read further in this poem by Matthias Claudius, the next verse reveals that the poet's meaning was precisely the opposite of what the priest wished to convey. The interesting thing here is that Matthias Claudius was the translator of St. Martin's title of Truth and Error, that it was he who translated St. Martin. Such things can show you, my dear friends, what kind of people oppose us today, on what they call good grounds, and what the nature of these motives are. I could expand at great length on the kinds of people we are dealing with here, but it is a shame to waste time refuting people who oppose us in this way. But sometimes one experiences much more curious things, and one of these I would like to relate now because of its great interest. It happened to me since we last met here. You all know, for I mentioned it again last time, that for reasons to do solely with truth, I could not and might not go along with what Mrs. Besant, president of the Theosophical Society, was doing with her group, a large number of whom she had prepared in the way I just described to you. I could not go along with this. In the name of truth, I had to take a stand against this frivolous view of Christ associated with the Alcyon boy. All the more so since I saw that even scholarly individuals were very taken with the little pamphlet said to be written by Alcyon, called, I believe, Title at the Feet of the Masters, and heralded it as one of the greatest phenomena of modern times. In those circles around Mrs. Besant, though, some did have a sense that I was serving the truth. They sensed this. But at the same time, those who felt this were in doubt as to whether truth was really something that should cause them to take a stand against Mrs. Besant for being less than truthful. And then I find in a pamphlet by a member of our society, E. von Gumpenberg, also due to be published shortly, a statement, a judgment about me. It is quoted word for word, this judgment about me. Frau von Gumpenberg quotes a comment about me by someone else and then says, this is reminiscent of another verdict on Dr. Steiner made on one occasion by an English lady who said, quote, the good Dr. Steiner is a philosopher, and this may be why he is so careful with the truth. What does it matter if Mrs. Besant is less truthful? Don't we all tell fibs? Surely it is inevitable. How would we get through life if we were always strictly truthful? We cannot all be philosophers. Let us therefore allow people to fib, for it will only cause trouble if we oppose this. Close quote. My dear friends, I cannot help thinking that a bandit is a more decent person than someone who holds such a view. That is really what I think and feel, however finely dressed the person who holds this opinion. I am sure the lady in question was indeed dressed in the finest fashion. But from such things, we can see how dangerous it is to be sparing with the truth today, in particular where matters not accessible to direct sensory perception are concerned. Hypocrisy holds sway in the dissemination of spiritual views by incausa, by papists, for these people call themselves Martinistes. Here we really have to defend the honest, unknown philosopher and his upright quest for truth, along with his endeavors to serve the 18th century. We must guard his name from wrongful use by modern Papusians. Now it is very important to know that every occult brotherhood is founded on 3 degrees. In the first degree, when symbolism is used in the right way, by which I mean, of course, what I have just intimated as the right path for our 5th post-Atlantean epoch, souls advance to a point where they have a precise inner experience of a knowledge independent of ordinary physical sensory knowledge. What is contained in my title, Occult Science, is broadly what every member of the first degree should know in our 5th post-Atlantean epoch. In the second degree or grade, each person should know, and that means having a living inward knowledge, what is contained in the book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds. And at the third degree, having received the significant symbols of sign, handshake, and word, one should know what it means to live outside the body. These would be the rules if schooling were properly handled. And that is in fact what was achieved within these grades or degrees in certain regions of Europe up until the 8th or 9th centuries. In Ireland, for instance, what I have described was to a great degree achieved fully by individuals, by a great number of them, before the 8th or 9th centuries, and also in other regions of Europe, though not in such great numbers as in Ireland. Certain things were avoided simply through lack of ability, that is, the capacity to work toward a real science of the spirit. For many reasons, this real science of the spirit is only now approaching us. But as I said, occult brotherhoods have always existed, and they work out of nothing but symbolism. This is especially significant when people work out of nothing but symbolism within a nation, a national community that has not yet reached full maturity. This was the cause of the mischief and confusion that arose immediately under Catherine the Great and her successor Emperor Paul, when an attempt was made to transplant certain secret societies from the West to Russia after Voltairianism had suffered something of a setback. This attempt was comprehensive in its scope, and what occurred at this time, under the influence of occult brotherhoods, transplanted from the West to Russia, has had a great influence since then on the whole of Russia's spiritual and cultural development, a much greater influence than people can credit. Naturally, such an influence affects different fields in different ways. Novelists assimilate it through their novels, political authors in politics. But on certain always present paths, such an influence always has an impact on subsequent developments. And in fact, everything of significance in Russian culture up to Tolstoy points us back more or less to the time I have referred to, when certain occult brotherhoods were transplanted from Western Europe to Russia. Now, I said that a certain substructure exists, the 3 degrees through which members of the occult brotherhoods advance. Then there are those who attain so-called high degrees, higher grades. Naturally, this is a realm where vanity has a great deal of scope. For there are fraternities in which one can progress through 90 levels or even more. Let us consider for a moment what it means to attain such a high status in an order of this kind. The so-called Scottish degree system, founded on the 3 grades that develop as I described, has 33 degrees. And this is simply because of an error arising from grotesque ignorance. First come the 3 levels, which, as you see, have a deep significance, but then there follow 30 more. You can imagine that if one has already acquired the capacity in the 3rd degree to have body-free experiences, one must indeed be a very advanced adept if one can progress through a further 30 grades after this. But this is based on a grotesque misunderstanding and misperception. You see, in occult sciences, numbers are read in a different way from the decimal system, based instead on a system appropriate to the numbers under consideration. So the 33rd degree, in fact, in the system of numbers under consideration here, signifies 3 times 3, or 9. This played an important role for Blavatsky. In her title Secret Doctrine, you can find a long debate about the number 777. People came up with all sorts of fantasies about the meaning of this number. In reality, it is 343. Or, in other words, 7 times 7 times 7. In occultism, one multiplies written numbers with one another. And so to find the real number involved here, one multiplies 7 by 7 to get 49, and then that number with 7 again to obtain 343. Accordingly, 33 is 9, the product of 3 times 3. It is only because people are unaware of this that they read it as 33 instead of 9. Leaving such foolishness and vanity aside, there are then 6 further legitimate grades after the 1st 3. And when a person is properly schooled in them, they endow him with very significant advances. But no one in our present era can really fully undergo these stages of schooling. It is simply impossible. No one can undergo these stages in their entirety, since in the 5th post-Atlantean epoch, humanity has not developed to the point where this would be possible. So far, you see, not enough knowledge, well, not knowledge, but activation of knowledge, of worlds of spirit has emerged. This still has to emerge, and will do so gradually. Since around 1413, we have been in the 5th post-Atlantean epoch, which will last a long time, roughly 2160 years, and will not end, therefore, until 3573. Thus, we are still only at the beginning of this period. During this 5th post-Atlantean epoch, a very great deal will happen, and the development of spiritual science is integral to this. But this can only slowly manifest, although we can certainly already discern the broad outlines and can also convey many details, too. But a very great deal will only emerge through meeting resistance and developing strength by this encounter. And this resistance will keep growing ever greater. As you can see from the things I have related during these lectures, and we'll see, too, from diverse other things I can relate, we now live in relatively idealistic spiritual times compared to what is to come. We live at the end of the second Christian millennium, but shortly after this millennium ends, humanity will experience strange and curious things, which today are only slowly being prepared. We can say that two poles are rapidly developing, are in preparation respectively, in East and West. Toward more Eastern regions, but emerging from national traits and quite obviously not from those circles that now misgovern the peoples of Eastern Europe, a quite different kind of thinking about the human being will increasingly develop. In the not-too-distant future, people will come to see the developing child in a quite different way from current tendencies. When a child is born, people will try to ask what might manifest in this child. They will discern a hidden spiritual being slowly developing within this child and will seek to decipher the riddle of this being. A kind of ritual will be connected with the growth and development of the child. This is in preparation in Eastern regions and will naturally play over into Europe too. The consequence will be a huge respect that develops for the genius of each child. A search for this genius. It is self-evident, isn't it? That when an age develops toward this outlook, the educational traditions that are currently so prevalent must die away. This era is approaching from the East, but will encompass a smaller portion of humanity. The greater portion of humanity will be affected by influences from America, from the West, and this will pursue a different form of development, one that is so far showing only its first idealistic traces and sympathetic beginnings compared with what will come. We can say that our current times are in pretty good shape compared with what will come when Western development increasingly puts forth its blossoms. Not very long after the year 2000, a kind of prohibition on all thinking, though not a direct one, will issue from America. A law that will have the aim of suppressing all individual thinking. The beginnings of this can be seen already in what materialistic medicine is doing, where no account can be taken of the soul anymore, but where, based on empirical experiments, the human being is treated like a machine. But please don't misunderstand me, since even in the so-called spiritual domain, much here is done in a hugely misguided way. People can sometimes come along and say, "I had all kinds of orthodox treatment and was not cured. Then I went to a person who treated me spiritually, who told me there are evil spirits in my body and I must get rid of them, initially by praying. This was what someone told me recently, so I asked him whether it helped. No, he said, I got much, much worse." And so I asked him to reflect on what situation he had been placed in. "Do not think," I said, "that what the man told you was wrong. It is quite true that there were certain spiritual beings in you that caused your disorder. But it is precisely because the man told you something correct, something you had to acknowledge as true, that he had to harm you in this way. Think of it like this. A good-for-nothing nuisance comes along and breaks a machine. He is the real reason why it no longer works. So how do I get the machine to work again? Following the method of your spiritual physicians, I would have to get hold of the fellow, give him a beating, and then when he runs off, imagine this means that everything will work properly again. He told you that once the evil spirits have gone, all will be well again. But just as little as the good-for-nothing running off will mend the machine, which still needs to be fixed, the same is true for you. Whether you get rid of the spirits or not is ultimately of as little importance for your healing as if I were to give that fellow a beating so that he runs away. Actually, I could let him stand there and watch as I mend the machine. So, with a spiritual outlook too, a great deal can be misperceived, since people are not very good at thinking nowadays. Rather than swinging back and forth between one extreme and the other, between either or, we should try to gain real insight into the fact that spirit indwells all matter, and that the body can only be cured through knowledge of the spirit. But as things are set to develop, the spirit will be excluded from the whole picture. That is one of the beginnings we are witnessing. And here is another. Today we already have machines for adding and subtracting, don't we? All very useful and easy. We no longer need to calculate for ourselves. And this will become the norm for everything. It will take only a couple of centuries to arrive, and then people will no longer need to think or reflect, but only push things around. For instance, today, if we need to send 330 balls of wool to Liverpool, we have to think how to do it, don't we? But soon you will need only to push or press, and the thing will be done. And to ensure that the firm coherence of social structures is not disrupted in future, laws will be issued that do not directly prohibit individual thinking, but whose effect will be to exclude it, render it void. That is the other pole toward which we are tending. By comparison, life today is really not so bad. Today we are still allowed to think, aren't we? As long as we don't overstep a certain boundary. But what I have described is implicit in the development of the West, and will emerge as the West develops. Spiritual scientific development must also place itself into this overall course of development. It will have to perceive it clearly and objectively. We must be clear that what seems paradoxical today will come about. In the year 2200, roughly, and a little more, thinking will start to be suppressed in the world to the greatest possible extent, and spiritual science must engage with this tendency, must and will find enough to offer as a counterbalance in cosmic evolution to these tendencies. We have seen only the beginnings of these trends so far, and they will become increasingly apparent. It is certainly true that the six higher grades of initiation can only partially be achieved, only partly worked through. But instead of this, one can engage in something quite different, can just let people pass symbolically through the first three grades. And indeed, there are brotherhoods today in which only symbols are given and nothing more. The people concerned are often even proud of this fact, that nothing more than symbols are offered. They are admitted to the first grade, advance into the second, and then the third, and actually they acquaint themselves there only with symbolism, without actually absorbing anything of spiritual science. And if you ask them whether this really satisfies them, whether it is enough for them to learn certain ceremonies, handshakes and symbols, to witness certain symbolic actions and rites performed around them in a temple room, many say that they are perfectly satisfied with this, since they do not need to think anything during these rites, and because each person can interpret them as he likes. But the astral body thereby conveys real knowledge into the etheric body, and in this way the etheric bodies of those involved receive comprehensive knowledge. And if you take a look at the most narrow-minded of Freemasons today, you will see that actually they possess vast knowledge in their etheric body, not in their physical body, in their conscious awareness, but in their etheric bodies. especially when they have reached the third grade. They possess a huge subconscious knowledge. This knowledge that can be conveyed and passed on through symbolism can be used in the manner suggested both for honest and dishonest purposes. There are, you see, the most diverse occult connections. And again, these appear at two extremes. The character of the one is worldly and Christian, while that of the other is Christian in an ecclesiastical sense. The Freemasons must be counted amongst the worldly Christian symbolic brotherhoods, while the Jesuits have ecclesiastical symbolic connections. The Jesuit is led through the three grades in the same way, likewise in association with symbols. And through this symbolism he learns to acquire a language of huge efficacy. This is why Jesuit orators are so immensely influential. They know how one builds up a speech in order to influence the uneducated masses, how to keep intensifying their message. An educated listener will sometimes find what they say very trivial, and yet it is hugely influential. On one occasion, I wished to see the effect that emanates from an influential Jesuit sermon. See it clairvoyantly, I mean. I listened to a sermon, this is many years ago now, given by Father Klinkaufstrom, one of the most effective Jesuit preachers, before a crowd who had gathered to hear him, naturally all uneducated people. He sought to impress on them the need for Easter confession. He was trying to show these uneducated people in irrefutable terms, so that they would accept it as something self-evident, without any need for real understanding, that the Easter confession was not arbitrarily ordained by the Pope, but was established by higher, divine powers. He said the following, "My dear Christians, imagine that you see a cannon and a gunner beside it, holding the fuse. Someone gives him the order to fire. Imagine, dear Christians, that the cannon is about to be fired. What happens if a cannon is to be fired? The gunner stands expectantly beside his cannon. What is he waiting for? For the word of command, fire. He waits for this word of command, fire. This lives in his soul. He knows very clearly that this will come. And then it comes. Fire! He shoots. The cannon thunders. Dear Christians, please picture these things very clearly. Now, consider the cannon as the assembly of customs relating to the Easter confession. Previously, the laws and commands about this Easter confession had not yet been given. But the cannon stood there. These commands were to be given. The Pope stood there as the gunner with the lit fuse. And from heaven, dear Christians, came the command, fire. The Pope heard it, fuse. The cannon fired. The Easter confession now existed. Can we not exactly equate this cannon and the ordaining of Easter confession? But the unfaithful, dear Christians, claim that the Pope himself invented the Easter confession. You need only remember the cannon. At the command, fire, it shoots. Would it ever occur to you to say that this gunner who shoots the cannon on the command, fire, had invented the gunpowder that fires it? And equally, dear Christians, you cannot say that the Pope invented the Easter confession. The Pope did not invent it, just as the gunner did not invent the gunpowder. All were convinced. The whole church was won over. This was very cleverly done indeed, very skillfully done in pictures. Such people also pass through their three grades in their own way. And naturally, the most diverse nuances exist between such orders, just as not all occult brotherhoods are Freemasons. In Germany, we even have the Illuminati and such like. But in both kinds, the worldly and ecclesiastical, three higher grades follow the three lower ones. Those who are admitted to the higher grades, and those who progress to the highest grades of all in certain fraternities, in some but not all of these societies, of course, form a kind of community with each other. And so, for example, it is certainly possible for a high-ranking member of a Jesuit order to belong to such a community or association. Of course, the Jesuits are very fierce in their opposition to Freemason societies, and the latter equally fierce in their opposition to the Jesuits. And yet, high-ranking Freemasons and Jesuits also belong to the higher grades of a special brotherhood, forming a state within a state that encompasses the others. Just picture what you can achieve in the world if you are on the one hand a high-ranking member of a Freemason order who employs this community to exert influence, but at the same time you can agree a joint action with a high-ranking Jesuit that can only be undertaken by using the means at the latter's disposal. On the other hand, you can mobilize the forces available to you through your brother Freemasons to vigorously pursue some aim through all channels. But if you only instigate something from one direction, it comes to nothing. At the same time, you have to unleash forces of opposition to combat it from the other direction, and do so with the same fire, the same enthusiasm. Imagine what you can achieve if you have such a mechanism available to you. Something like this happened in a certain country in northwestern Europe between Holland and France, where Jesuits and Freemasons together set something very effective in motion without the rest of the Jesuits or Freemasons knowing of it. This had very powerful effects, not in very recent times, but for a long period, which had many repercussions and served the interests of both streams. We've run out of time now. In a week's time, my dear friends, I will pursue these reflections in a more tangible way. Today I had to consider their more abstract aspects. We needed the whole foundation first, since only then can we understand how influences act in this way, in this domain, in the outer world. The end of Lecture 4.